ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Remember that Black Mirror episode where you're scored on what kind of citizen you are? For renters, that already exists. Real estate platforms are now collecting up to 50 points of data on anyone who wants to rent a home. I'm Ray Johnston, and on Download This Show, I'm investigating what rental tech is doing to your chances of finding somewhere to live. To hear the series, search Download This Show on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm David Rutledge, and it's great to be with you for a conversation this week about appropriately directed anger.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
When Greta Thunberg made that famous address at the UN Climate Action Summit in September 2019, she was clearly very angry. And 7 years later, as another El Niño event appears to be intensifying and we can get ready for another summer of stress and worry about extreme climate events, you too may well be feeling angry at the relative lack of progress, the efforts of fossil fuel corporations in pushing back against effective climate action, the spinelessness of politicians in failing to push back against the corporations, or you might be keeping it local and feeling cranky at your neighbours because they just bought a giant V8 diesel SUV. When it comes to something like climate change, it can be hard to know exactly where to direct that anger. There can be a certain satisfaction in targeting this or that individual, but at the end of the day, we all know that climate change is a systemic problem, and no single individual or group of individuals is really responsible for it. But then if we consider the system, then getting angry with that can feel a little bit like shaking your fist at the sky. The system can't see or hear you, it can't feel shame or remorse, and it can't resolve to do better. Well, all of this has been very much on the mind of my guest this week.
I'm Stephanie Collins. I'm an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Monash University, and I have worked mostly on the ethics of care, collective responsibility, group agency, and individuals' obligations in the face of collective action problems.
Earlier this year, Stephanie Collins spoke at the annual conference of the Australasian Association of Philosophy on this problem of determining where to locate the responsibility for injustices suffered as the result of social systems, where to direct those reactive attitudes of indignation, resentment, and anger. So we're talking about structural injustice, systemic injustice. Let's begin with the question of why it is so hard to say who is responsible for systemic injustice.
Yeah, so a good way into that question is by contrasting systemic injustice with interactional injustice. So if I take a garden hose and flood your house, it's pretty clear who's culpable. It's me. I have committed a wrong against you. Whereas if your house floods because of sea level rise, which is a result of anthropogenic climate change, which is happening increasingly in the Pacific, places are getting flooded as a result of king tides and so on, who is it that you can blame? Who is it that you can take your outrage and anger to? The answer to that is pretty unclear, because that injustice of kind of anthropogenic climate change, let's say, results from a global system rather than from the actions of any one identifiable agent. So when an injustice is systemic, the causal chain that links agents to unjust outcomes is pretty diffuse. Each of us, when we, say, drive a car or book a flight, or if we're a fossil fuel corporation, you know, when we open up a new mine, all of these actions increase the likelihood of, say, your house flooding from king tides, but they don't directly cause that unjust outcome in ways that are kind of traceable. So the causal chain is diffuse. Also, because we're kind of bound together in this global system, each of our actions that link together with others to cause unjust outcomes are constrained by the roles that we play in the system, right? If I'm a commuter and I'm thinking about how to get to work and I'm thinking, well, I could ride my bike or I could take the tram or I could drive, which of those options is open to me is determined by the physical infrastructure that I live in, decisions of city planners, the decisions that, or outcomes, I should say, that aren't the result of any decision, right? That are just to do with the way that kind of urban sprawl has and suburban sprawl has gone on over the years. So the choices that agents face within these systems are constrained. And this is kind of related, those constraints are the result of these historically entrenched paths. So the fact that we're now so reliant on fossil fuels in our economy results from centuries of the entrenchment of those systems that none of us alive today kind of initiated. So all of that constrains the ability of agents to make choices that totally extract themselves from systemic injustice. And then add to all of that, that the injustices that result are in some way more than the sum of the wrongs that any one agent perpetuates. So we can talk about your house flooding, that's a wrong, but we can also talk about this more holistic thing, which is sea level rise or temperature increases or unpredictable weather patterns. These kind of holistic harms that sort of describe or subsume the more micro level harms that are experienced by particular individuals. And those more holistic or systemic or structural harms that can only be described in these kind of overarching ways, like no agent is culpable for those holistically described harms. So all of that means, right, that when we're talking about culpability for the wrongs that result from social systems, it's really hard to say which agent, if any, is the one that's responsible for those injustices.
And it's interesting here that you actually prefer the term system to the term structural. Like, we talk about structural injustice and systemic injustice more or less interchangeably. Why do you prefer system here?
A simple way to put it is just that a system is dynamic and robust and changeable in a way that a structure is often not understood to be. So if we intuitively we think about a structure, we might think about something like a house, right? Or a bridge. It's something that has parts that relate to one another via certain relations, such as the holding up relation or the sitting on top of relation, right? These structures are somewhat rigid. They're not dynamic and fluid and changeable through time and not always robust to external shocks. Whereas when social ontologists talk about systems as opposed to structures, they're really thinking of something that is adaptable, that's dynamic, that kind of contains the seeds for its own continuation, even in the face of external shocks. So I'm not that interested in policing people's language, and many authors in this literature talk about structural injustice. In fact, that's the label that's most common for philosophers that write about the kinds of phenomena like climate change or homelessness or these kinds of phenomena that are often taken to be structural or systemic injustices. I prefer system because it emphasizes the dynamism and the robustness of these processes that result in these unjust outcomes.
You've referred in your work to the famous How Dare You speech that Greta Thunberg made at the 2019 United Nations Climate Action Summit. What does that example show us here?
Well, I think it's a really evocative example for evoking this question of who it is that we can blame. So Thunberg she says, how dare you? And we'll never forgive you. And the question I want to answer is, who's the you there? Who's she talking to? I mean, obviously she's talking to a particular group of agents in a particular context. Maybe she's angry at each of those agents. Probably she is angry at each of those agents. But notice that no one of those agents caused climate change all on their own, right? We can't look at any one of those agents and say, you are responsible for climate change, right? That wouldn't be quite right. So it seems like although she might be angry at each of them, it's not the case that each of them is culpable for the holistic injustice, although they certainly are each culpable for their own individual contributions to that holistic injustice. So then you might think, okay, maybe in order to capture kind of who she's angry at about the holistic injustice, the systemic overall injustice, we say she's angry at the group. Groups, though, are just collections of agents, where that collection isn't understood as structured or systematized via the relations between the agents in the group. So a group is just a kind of unsystematized collection of objects. So she might be angry at the group, but it seems like in order to explain the systemic injustice or the holistic harm, whatever you want to call it, we have to refer not just to this collection of agents, but also to the relations between them. Relations of buying and selling certain products, relations of negotiation, and so on and so forth. And so once we refer to the group in that way, as something that is composed of agents or objects that are systematized in relation to one another, now we're talking about a social system, right? And so it seems to me like the best way to explain who the you is in that "how dare you" speech is to understand the you as the system.
I guess the thing is, though, that systems, of course, don't have minds. They can't feel remorse. They can't be shamed. They can't understand why you're angry. Why isn't being angry at the system something of a category error, you know, like being angry at the weather or something like that?
Yeah, so this is a question that I get all the time when I present this material in philosophy seminars, I've got to say. So I think there are a few important differences between social systems and the weather. So one is that social systems are, in my view, materially composed of agents in the same way that like a table is materially composed of the legs and the top, right? So there's no kind of mysterious metaphysical emergence going on here. The system isn't some ghost hovering over on top of the agents. It's just made of them in this very everyday intuitive way that we see in ordinary objects, right? So because of that, as soon as you have a social system, you have agents that are on the scene, right? They come along for free, whereas that's not true with the weather. And when you have agents that are on the scene or that kind of come along for free, there are entities there who can respond, or the term I use is be the recipients of your anger or your blame or your indignation or resentment, even though your attitudes, the anger, the blame, the resentment, are not targeted at those agent constituents of the system, because as we've just said, the agent constituents aren't really the one that caused the holistic harm. So agents come along for free in the social systems case, and they can respond, they can be the recipients, whereas that's not the case for the weather. Also in social systems, although the agents are very constrained by the system, they do have some agency within the system, right? Take the commuter example again, right? I can make choices about how to get to work, even though those choices are constrained. So not only are there agents on the scene, there's also a little bit of what Maeve McEwen calls elbow room for these agents. But although there are agents and there's agency, it's nonetheless true that what it is that caused the holistic harm, or what's kind of the best explanation of that harm, is systemic rather than referring just to the actions of individual agents. So this combination of agents and agency with systemic or holistic level explanations, I think, makes social systems different from the weather and can make attitudes like anger or indignation and resentment apt when they're not apt regarding the weather.
But if we're all encouraged to direct our outrage at the system, why doesn't that let specific culpable individuals off the hook a little too easily? Like, if there's a fossil fuel executive who's lobbying against climate regulation, I feel like I want to be angry with them and, you know, see them held accountable in some way that's specific and personal.
Absolutely. And I don't want to foreclose those attitudes. So agents within the system are 100% culpable for how they use the levers that the system makes available to them. And fossil fuel executives or politicians that approve the expansion of fossil fuel projects, or all of these kinds of agents, are culpable for those contributions. What's not the case, though, is that we can hold each of those agents culpable for the entire systemic injustice. So I think we need to be quite careful with pairing up our reactive attitudes in terms of the targets of those attitudes with the specific thing that we are targeting them for. So agents are culpable for their contributions, the system as a whole is culpable for the overall holistic harm. I definitely don't want to let fossil fuel corporations off the hook, but I think it's also important to acknowledge what it is that they're culpable for, partly because if we say that they're culpable for the holistic injustice taken as a whole, then they have these weaselly ways of getting out of that. We've seen this actually in some international climate change litigation, particularly around Shell, a case against Shell in the Netherlands, where Shell managed to successfully argue, hey, we're not culpable for climate change. And in a way, like, that's true. But what we should say they're culpable for is their contribution, and we should go after them for that.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, I'm David Rutledge. I'm right here with my guest Stephanie Collins from Monash University, and we are in the Philosopher's Zone talking about how to attribute responsibility for systemic injustice. When individuals are too small to carry the blame, but the system is too large, too nebulous, who exactly should we be angry with? On that question of blame, though, I mean, blame is interesting because it's often thought to work by seeking kind of rational uptake, you know, getting the wrongdoer to recognize the wrong and then to change. A system can't recognize anything. Is that a problem for your argument here?
It's a problem depending on what you take the attitudes that we have towards systems to be doing. So I actually want to make a bit of a distinction between blame and reactive attitudes. I know we've been sort of treating them interchangeably in this conversation so far, which is fine, and that's how many people do it. But for me, it might be true that blame has this, what Michael McKenna calls, conversational character. So it might be that blame, constitutively or conceptually as a matter of necessity, and invites this kind of response of defense or justification or whatever, and then forgiveness or however the story goes. So blame is kind of conversational in that way. Reactive attitudes, I think, needn't be. Reactive attitudes don't necessarily demand a response from their target. Now, they might demand a response from the agents that are somehow associated with the target. So remember I said social systems are constituted by agents. Those agents can respond. Those agents can, if you like, take up the reactive attitude and act on that basis. But importantly, when we're targeting our reactive attitudes at the social system, the agents that make up that social system are not going to react, or they needn't react, in the same kind of defensive, justificatory way that an agent might react if we're targeting our indignation and resentment at them, right? So my thought is we're resentful and indignant at the social system. The agents that constitute that system can respond by trying to change the system, by taking up forward-looking responsibility to work their levers inside the system in a way that changes the system. But because our blame or our reactive attitudes were never actually targeted at them per se, they needn't get defensive or start worrying about their clean hands and, you know, trying to kind of deflect the blame, because, hey, the blame's not targeted at them, right? Their resentment and indignation is targeted at the system. Agents can respond to it positively by taking up forward-looking actions to try and change the system, but it prevents, I hope, agents from getting too defensive because they're not the target.
On that issue of individual agents just sort of working whatever levers they have to hand, I'd like to talk a little bit more about, you know, the forward-looking responsibility. If blame is something that we apportion to things that have happened, what about the way that individuals within the system behave in the future? You know, we don't want to pile all the forward-looking responsibility onto ordinary individuals who may have very little choice about the roles that they occupy. So tell me a bit more about working those levers. This is where what you call contextual care comes in, right?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. So backward looking, we're being indignant and resentful at the system. Forward looking, who are we attributing obligations and duties to? That's a completely different question on my account. We're attributing obligations and duties to agents that are associated with the system or that are connected via the system to those that are treated unjustly by the system. Now, when I say agents here, importantly, I don't primarily, I certainly don't only mean like ordinary individuals like you and I. So agents are really importantly going to include collective agents like Australia or Woodside or so any other kinds of collective agents. States and corporations are the ones that I focus on the most. These collective agents are going to stand in the kinds of connections that are mediated by the social system to those who are harmed by the system that are going to give them very weighty obligations or duties to pull the particular levers that are available to them. So obligations are definitely not primarily piled on individuals because we have less power, we have less capacity, we're less of a causal contributor than powerful collective agents. But contextual care, this term that you mentioned, this concept that I develop, is going to apply to both individual agents and collective agents that are connected to the system. So contextual care, in my rendering, is acting on one's local part of the system with the aim of meeting the needs of those that are treated unjustly by the system in a way that also aims to promote wider systemic change. So it's kind of, in a slogan, you know, I know the slogan has been around for decades, you know, think global, act local, right? It's a way, this concept of contextual care is a way of sort of philosophically fleshing out that slogan. And contextual care for powerful collective agents is going to look quite different than what it looks like for individuals. For powerful collective agents, it's going to look like managing their internal systems, their value chain, which is everything from where they get their resources to what's done with, say, their products after those products are discarded. It's going to look like industry-level regulation, so kind of banding together with other collective entities in the industry to try and regulate, self-regulate the industry, and so on and so forth. For individuals, contextual care is going to look like lobbying within the particular roles that you hold, be those professional roles, community roles, family roles, whatever, to try and create change within those local environments. You know, for an individual, you might think about, you know, where your pension fund is held and what your pension fund is doing with your investments and so on and so forth. So contextual care is going to apply to both collective and individual agents. It's going to look slightly different in each case. And the weight or extent of cost that's demanded is going to differ between collective and individual agents. Collective agents are going to have more demanded of them.
Yeah, one commonly encountered criticism, though, of this idea of start where you are and act locally approach, it sees that approach as exactly the kind of incrementalism that can end up making an unjust system just bearable enough to survive, but without forcing it to be replaced, right?
Absolutely. And this is the classic kind of Marxist objection to the kind of approach that I'm talking about. You know, the thought being, if we act locally to improve things for those who are treated unjustly by the system, then they're not going to have the motivation to band together and really overthrow the system and build something new. This is a really important classic objection. So I think one thing to say is it's important to distinguish between the short-term meeting of needs and the long-term meeting of needs. And we should always be thinking long-term, I should say. So it might be that the way to meet needs in the long-term is to act locally in such a way as to build collaborations, build solidarity, build alliances between different pockets of local action in a way that is in the long term oriented towards wider systemic change. So that can be contextual care. Contextual care needn't be short term or short sighted or only about needs that can be met in the short term. And the other thing to say is that, yes, immediate systemic change would be great, but no singular agent, be it individual or collective, can take that on themselves, right? So if we're thinking realistically about what any one agent can do, it's always going to be pulling the levers that they have available, because the nature of social systems is such that each of us is an agent within it, and none of us has this kind of God's eye perspective of being able to change it wholesale. So I think this idea of contextual care or pulling the levers that are available to you just respects this fundamental principle that autumn plays can. Yes, we are aiming at systemic change, but we're doing that with a sensitivity to where we are positioned in the system and what possibilities are available for us.
I'm interested in this question of how we apportion degrees of responsibility, because if we think of ordinary interpersonal ethics, you know, we're all very used to reasoning in degrees about, you know, how much we owe a close friend versus a stranger, this sort of thing. But when it comes to the more sort of the larger systemic issues, how do we actually weigh how much responsibility any one of us has when everyone's web of relations is different and the causal chains are also tangled?
There are two issues here. One of them is an epistemic issue about how do I know the extent of my responsibility and who do I owe it to? And the other one is a kind of metaphysical issue about what actually is the extent of my responsibility. So just on the epistemic issue, I think there's a general epistemic obligation on all agents to try insofar as we can, again, ought always implies can, to understand the nature of the social systems that we're embedded in and how it is that those systems connect us to those that the system treats unjustly. That is difficult to discharge, that general epistemic responsibility. It is going to be proportionate to one's capacity, obviously, to the competing obligations that one has in one's life. And we can all kind of only do so much. So that's on how it is that we know. I mean, none of that is a groundbreaking thing to say. That's, you know, fairly obvious things to say. But that's on the question of how we can know what our obligations are. On the question of once we've done that epistemic duty, what are we going to uncover? what kind of are the bases of our differential responsibilities? On my view, the extent of any one agent's obligation, that is the amount of cost that's demanded from them, is dependent on the types and number of relations that they stand in to those that are treated unjustly by the system, where those relations are relations like being a causal contributor to the fact that the system treats that person unjustly, benefiting from the fact that the system treats that person unjustly, having the capacity to change the fact that the system treats that person unjustly, being in community with the person that the system is treating unjustly. So all those kinds of relations, which are conceptually distinct from one another, if you like, add up to determine the extent that can be demanded of any given agent. So in that way, we can say, well, the agents that contribute more, benefit more, have greater ability or stand in community with those who are treated unjustly by the system, those agents have a greater cost that can be demanded of them than those who stand in fewer such relations. And that's going to allow us to differentiate a bit between how much we demand in this forward-looking way of different agents. And I hope that that will do something to allow any one agent to situate themselves relative to others and say, okay, yeah, my obligations are somewhat demanding, but hey, they're not as demanding as the obligations of, I don't know, a powerful corporate agent who stands in more of these duty-generating relations than I do.
Yeah. Or indeed a nation. I mean, you've argued that the broader and deeper the extent of your responsibility for injustice is, the more that you owe, which is why states owe more than individuals. And you've put that argument to work in the context of Australia's responsibility for Pacific climate displacement. What does that actually look like? What does Australia as a country owe versus what an individual Australian owes?
Yeah, so I'm really happy that you brought up that example of Pacific climate displacement. I'm working on that on what I'm thinking of as kind of separate and collaborative project with various collaborators across Australia and the Pacific. But it definitely connects up with this work. So when it comes to Pacific climate displacement, we can look at Australia as a nation that has, first of all, high levels of greenhouse gas emissions per capita, so has been a large causal contributor to the fact of the various climate effects that are causing people in the Pacific to have to think about moving. So it's got that causal relation in a way that's stronger than the causal relation that, say, you or I as individuals have. Australia has also benefited a lot from the fact of climate change because so many of our big industries rely on the fact of fossil fuel emissions being an ongoing phenomenon. Australia also has the capacity to respond to this situation by standing in partnership and having genuine dialogue with people in the Pacific that are affected by the prospect of climate displacement or climate migration. And Australia is in community with Pacifica people. I mean, Australia is in the Pacific, has a very large Pacific population. It's geographically situated in the Pacific. And so in all these ways, Australia, the state, stands in these duty-generating relations of interdependence via which the system puts Australia in relation with those that the system is treating unjustly. And that places strong obligations on Australia to listen to the people that are being treated unjustly by the system, to, you know, stand in solidarity with them, stand in partnership with them. This is another important fact. So contextual care isn't just like, quote unquote, helping. It isn't acting paternalistically or beneficently towards those who are badly off, you know, from a position of kind of benevolent bestowing of benefits on others. It's rather a matter of treating those who are treated unjustly by the system as agents, as active participants in this process of contextual care and hearing what they want, right? So Australia has weighty obligations there. Of course, as citizens of Australia, when Australia has obligations, that implies obligations for the citizens. So it's not that citizens have nothing to do. Citizens should, you know, use their power or the levers that they have in their role as citizens. It's like voting and petitioning and protesting and everything else to try and get the state to do what it should. But those are obligations that we have in virtue of being part of this collective agent that has these obligations. They're not obligations that we have just in our capacity as kind of isolated individuals.
Okay, so the takeaway here for anyone listening who feels a kind of paralyzed guilt about climate change and they're unsure as to what one person can possibly do, are you saying that, you know, on one hand, you don't conclude that you're responsible for everything that the system does, but you don't conclude that you're responsible for nothing simply because you can't single-handedly fix it? What are we working on there? We're working on our own actual position within the system, within the structure?
Exactly. So what I really want to separate is the backward-looking aspects, the guilt and the resentment and the indignation from the forward-looking aspects, the obligation or the duty. So as an individual, as a little cog in this massive machine who feels that I have very few options available to me, what's not appropriate are those backward-looking attitudes of guilt and so on regarding the systemic injustice taken as a whole. I can, of course, and should feel those reactive attitudes if I fail in my obligations of contextual care. But those obligations are going to be relativized to my capacity, to the relations that I stand in, to the levers that I have available, and so on. So those obligations are not kind of to change the system single-handedly. That my obligation can't demand that of me, right? So backward-looking, I think guilt certainly for the systemic injustice taken as a whole is not appropriate. But then forward-looking, yeah, there are these obligations of contextual care, of pulling the levers that are available, of using your role within the system to try and make change to the local parts of the system in a way that has one eye to the broader systemic context. You can feel guilty if you don't perform those obligations, but don't think that those obligations are an obligation to like take the entire world on your shoulders. I think there lies the path of depression and anxiety and all those other bad emotions, burnout, that we sometimes see in, say, activist movements.
Yeah. What about anger? I mean, is it fine, even fitting, to stay angry at the system while we're doing all of this? I feel like I don't want to let go of the anger, you know?
Oh, absolutely. System targeting anger as opposed to agent targeting anger can be a real positive driver for change. So the philosopher Maisha Cherry has a recent book about this, The Case for Rage, where I think she makes a lot of great points. She's mostly talking about race politics in the US, but I think it applies to a case like climate change as well. Anger at the system, as well as being, in my view, fitting or apt in a backward-looking sense, it also has these forward-looking positive effects. It's an approach emotion, right, as psychologists would say. Anger causes us to act in a way that, say, depression doesn't. So, yeah, be angry at the system. Maybe abstain from being angry at agents, or at least be angry at them only for their contributions, not for the systemic injustice taken as a whole. And then use that anger as fuel to perform the forward-looking obligations. That would be the takeaway.
There it is. Stay angry, folks. You heard it here on The Philosopher's Zone. Steph, wonderful to talk. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, David. It was good fun.
Stephanie Collins. She's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Monash University in Melbourne, and she recently appeared at the annual conference of the Australasian Association of Philosophy to talk about culpability and obligation under structural injustice. More details on the Philosopher's Zone website. And speaking of the Australasian Association of Philosophy, you might be interested to know that they are going to be partnering up with ABC Radio National in just a few weeks' time to host the 2026 Alan Saunders Lecture. And it's a really interesting one this year. We have Alexander Lefebvre from the University of Sydney talking about the return of the moral state. One of the tenets of liberal democracy has always been that the state should never try to impose any particular idea of the good life on its citizens. But around the world, that is beginning to change, and it's throwing new light on this old question of should the state help to decide what makes life worth living? So that's the 2026 Alan Saunders Lecture. It's on Thursday, September the 24th at the ABC in Sydney. It's free to attend, but you do need to register, and registrations close a week out from the lecture on September 17. Now, that's a whole lot of information to remember, but luckily there's a webpage where you can get all the details and you can also register to attend. I'll be there. We'll have Q&A afterwards. It's going to be fun, and you can find a link to all the info on the Philosopher's Zone website. As always, this episode of The Philosopher's Zone was produced on the unceded lands of the Bundjalung people by me, David Rutledge. Thanks for your company, and I hope you can join me again next time. Bye for now.